This is the Money Talks Podcast with Michael Campbell.
Welcome to the Money Talks Podcast, and I'm glad you're with me. My name is Michael Campbell. Let me start with a quick question. Did you see anything in the throne speech that suggests we're in the middle of an economic and financial crisis? Because we are. And sorry to tell you, we are nowhere near the end of it. Also, stay with me because I've got Timer's Digest Timer of the Year, Mark Leibovit. He's going to drop by and tell me his latest on gold, silver, and stocks. Especially interesting given his model successfully predicted the current downturn. But he says there's a buying point coming. He'll tell us when. And stay with me for my quote of the week. I think it's the best summation of politics in Canada that I've read in years. Plus, I got a Goofy Award, don't worry, and it's focusing on the one group that's had it easiest during the pandemic. But first, the word crisis is defined by Webster's as a time or state of affairs requiring prompt or decisive action. And make no mistake, we are in a financial and economic crisis. Now, I get that people don't want to hear that. The attitude seems to be, hey, just keep sending me a check and I'll worry about the consequences later. But you know what? Economics and finance are not like politics. Photo ops, feel-good cliches only go so far. We've got 1.1 million additional people out of work. We got a $380 billion deficit and counting. Tens of thousands of businesses have shut their doors in a world that's lost $13 trillion in economic growth. And this is the point I want you to get. This isn't the final chapter. There's much more to come on the economic and financial story. It seems to be completely misunderstood or under-anticipated. But how much more damage depends on what governments do today, what actions they take. Last week, the Parliamentary Budget Officer stated that we can't keep spending like this. But what I find very worrisome is we have leaders who think that somehow we're going to be able to tax ourselves out of that problem. What an absurdity. And it shows a dangerous underestimation of what's going on. The only way to return to sustainable government finances, stop the flow of bankruptcies, pay for existing government promises in terms of programs, and solve the unemployment problem is through economic growth. I'm talking about solutions that impact real people. They need a job. They've got to pay rent. They've got to pay mortgages. They've got to save for retirement. They've got children to bring up. We regularly hear from experts that say the first step in returning to pre-pandemic levels of economic growth is to get the pandemic under control. Fair enough. Going back to the lockdown would be devastating. But every other step from that point on starts with economic growth. Without it, every other problem will continue. Joblessness, unsustainable government programs, charities looking for donations. You might want to raise. You name it. The foundation is economic growth. I said all along that prioritizing economic growth was a must if we're going to provide securities to Canadians and our communities. That's not the same thing as sending checks to individuals and businesses ad infinitum. I got to admit, I am sincerely surprised. You can shelve your political views. I'm talking about economics and finance, and I am surprised that 6 months into the pandemic, we don't have a clear economic recovery plan. And that's not just me saying it. The federal government admits it. They continue to promise one sometime in the fall. The suspension of Parliament was justified by the Prime Minister with a promise of new and bold action. But instead, the throne speech borrowed far more heavily from the past. And there was no sign of urgency, no prompt or decisive action that's justified by a crisis on economic growth. The majority of the speech was a rehash of policy promises taken directly from the 2019 federal election campaign or earlier. I mean, PharmaCare, come on. Daycare, which if memory serves, was first promised in 1993. I support that in order to help women back in the workforce or men. If they're forced to stay home because one of their children is sick due to the pandemic, we got to address that. So don't get me wrong. I'm just saying we've been hearing about that since 93. What about lofty goals like ending chronic homelessness? Come on. How often have we heard that before from all three levels of government politicians? When I heard the familiar buzzwords, though, and the shop-worn phrases like pandering to, in quotes, the middle class and those working hard to join it, come on, that was directly lifted from 2015, repeated several times. How many times have we heard that governments don't spend money, they invest it? Wow, Even more cringeworthy is they borrowed directly from Joe Biden's campaign, Build Back Better. That's already a cliche. My point is this: recycled campaign promises, recycled phrases do not reflect an understanding that we are in a crisis. I know, people seem to crave simplicity in a complex time. Our leaders seem to think that government spending on an array, vast array of areas, which reflect other agendas outside of the immediate and economic financial crisis, won't get it done. Lack of focus won't either, which seems to be guaranteed given the huge array of the government promises. We have no idea. You hear that phone speech, you had no idea what the priorities were, given the list of policy promises were so long. We have no idea as to how fast different policies could be implemented. But clearly, spurring on economic growth was not a priority. Contrary to what you hear, by the way, it's absolutely not as simple as government spending money and everything will be okay. I'll give you an example. Why not go back to the 2015 federal infrastructure program? First of all, it took way longer to implement. It took years. It resulted in virtually no meaningful increase in economic growth. As well-known economist David Rosenberg points out, the research looking into the last two decades of increased government spending found it actually hurt economic growth. I'll go into why another time. Now, I know, regular listeners know this about me. I can go on, but I won't today. Some people are going to put my concerns in a political context, but you've missed the point. The financial and economic challenges we face, just like COVID-19, couldn't care less about politics, their parties or leaders. History has consistently shown that when it comes to a tug of war between politics and finance/economics, politics loses every time. It brought down the former Soviet Union. It forces changes everywhere. Politics won't save us from the sovereign debt crisis and severe monetary problems that are coming much faster than people appreciate. Although I think the Parliamentary Budget Officer got it right. We're talking a two-year time frame. Politics are making it worse. So my message is clear. We're in the midst of an historic economic and financial crisis. And why we don't understand that is beyond me. But as I said, I know few want to hear that. But that isn't going to stop us from feeling the consequences. My most sincere thought in looking what's going on, and it scares the heck out of me, is that our leaders are miles over their head. They don't do economics and finance. They're probably typical of Canadians. They take our prosperity for granted, because they show no sign of understanding what's going on economically and financially. And one final point, that's why they did not see the problems in the credit market coming, the most profound disruption in the credit market since the financial crisis, that central banks are forced to be in the credit markets every single day because they're not functioning. Just tells me they show no sign of understanding what's going on economically and financially. They don't even know what they don't know. Michael Levy joins me on the line. Mike, I just alluded to this a moment ago, and that's the Parliamentary Budget Officer last week came out and said, you know, when he's talking about the deficit and the size of it, et cetera, and that's before any new programs were announced, he's sort of saying, hey, look, you got to get clear. This thing can't last more than one or two more years. There's a problem coming. I just want to get your take on what he said, especially in conjunction with the throne speech, not really mentioning it.
Well, first with the PBO, the Parliamentary Budget Office, Mike, you know, they're assuming, the government is assuming everything is static. Everything is going to stay the same. There's going to be no ups, there's going to be no downs, there's going to be no responsibility, there's going to be no obligations. Everything is static. And with that, debt never gets paid off. So with the government, go out and borrow indefinite amounts because interest rates are low. And they're going to stay low like this for years. At least they hope they're going to, and maybe even for decades. So we're borrowing all this money. The interest rates are low. I mean, when I say low interest rates, what, 0.5%, 0.375%? So you're not having to pay the significant interest rate amounts on your debt, and you just keep borrowing and piling it on, but with no vision to paying it off. But they're also looking, and I'll just deal with this for a minute, not only borrowing, Mike, going out on the marketplace and borrowing, but they're also going to, using their words, tax extreme wealth. That bothered me, because what is extreme wealth? But they're going to find a way to pile on more tax revenue by identifying ways to tax extreme wealth inequality. That's the throne speech words, the government words. Extreme wealth inequality. A wealth tax? What's extreme? What is a wealth tax? Are they going to tax the extremely wealthy? Who are the extremely wealthy? Well, in some cases, they're going to consider it you and I. Maybe a home equity tax, a tax on the gains when you sell your home. That's been floated by the government, and certainly it could be a significant way for them to raise revenue. Much higher capital gains tax, like they can take capital, and they've alluded to this, capital gains tax, when you buy and then sell something at a profit, you get a tax break because you have taken some risk, and the fact is the government will allow you a tax break in order to incentivize you to invest. This is investors that help to finance the running of our country, the running of business. Well, maybe we're going to tax capital gains at the same level that we tax your ordinary income. So the increasing taxation has little or no vision of paying down debt, but only looking for more revenues to spend. So basically, it's tax and spend, and as I said at the outset, borrow and spend.
Well, I think one of the things, I'll come back to the first point you make, and that's that, you know, the assumptions about going forward, 5 years out, 10 years out, and you're 100% right, in my opinion, that there's no intention of paying off the debt so that we're borrowing this year, for example. So it's just the interest cost. But to make the assumption that interest rates are never going up, I think that's a difficult one, because inherent in that assumption is a whole bunch of other stuff. Inherent, you know, this affordability argument rests on having things pretty much like they are. I think that's, you know, look back the last 10 years, see how static everything is. I think that's just a dangerous assumption to be making at this point.
Well, so do I. And I'd like for those that agree with this government policy of borrow and no thought of paying back because interest rates are low, of taxing and spending, why do we want to give government free license to spend our money, our kids' money, our grandkids' money, without accountability? And Mike, the perfect example is, if you want to go into the bank and you want to borrow money at these low interest rates, as long as you qualify, you can. But what we're not demanding of our government, the banks demand of us when we go in there, because you are held accountable at the bank when you borrow. It's great to have an interest-only loan. A lot of people have the financial wherewithal to have an interest-free loan. But one day, the bank wants to know that they're going to get their money back. And when you take a look at what the federal government is doing, they're borrowing with absolutely no vision of paying it back. It wouldn't work at the bank, but it's working for the government because the way they're structuring it.
Well, we'll see. They're still going to come out with some economic recovery plan. They still have to come up with a plan. I think a lot of people thought what was missing was even addressing the issues you've just brought up. We'll be there to chronicle it. Mike, go out and have a great weekend.
You too, Mike. Thank you.
Right after the show today, Andrew Rulin, president of Integrated Wealth Management, is going to do a webinar on this topic. And by the way, go to Money Talks, mikesmoneytalks.net. You can sign in. Unfortunately, it's a limited number of people. But the question I wanted to put to Andrew is, I'm personally worried about government bonds. What are my alternatives in that sort of thing? I know, obviously, stock market, but a lot of people should not want 100% stock portfolio. So can you give me just a quick preview of what you're going to do in the webinar in terms of alternatives to that Government of Canada bond?
Sure. Well, we're going to talk about, as I said, private alternatives to government bonds, or GICs. And the reason we're going to do that is frankly, the way that you invest the non-equity portion of your retirement portfolio will likely determine whether or not you actually run out of money later in life. And even if you don't actually run out of money, your estate will be significantly compromised. So that's the big fat idea itself. And that's why we're focusing on the private alternatives.
One of the questions I have, or one of the worries I have, is that people in search of yield, they don't want that 10-year bond at 0.55%. And as I know, you're so well aware of, you told your clients about, and if interest rates even bump up, you start losing capital to boot. You know, the worth of that bond is worth less. So, but I'm worried about them jumping into too much risk. Are you going to be dealing with that too?
Yeah, actually we are. And I mean, we know that the vast majority of people, especially those who are close to or already in retirement, do not really have the stomach for 100% equity portfolio, yeah. Even a dividend stock portfolio. So what we're going to focus on is how the non-equity portion, or what has traditionally been the fixed income portion of most people's portfolio, how the private alternatives fit in there as a logical and really intelligent high-yielding substitute for government bonds. Because, again, most people, while we might have the we might intellectually have the appetite for risk, when push comes to shove, we don't have the appetite for the volatility of all stocks.
Yeah, been there, done that, that's for sure. You know, everybody's everybody's all in until you get a decline. Yeah,
exactly.
So,
exactly.
Just a reminder then, go to mikesmoneytalks.ca, mikesmoneytalks.ca, and right there you can click on enjoy the webinar that's going to take place right after the show. And I think this is an incredibly important subject area here. Andrew, just give me a quick example of the kinds of alternatives I have. Can you just give me one, just as a teaser for what you're going to be doing later?
Sure, sure. We're actually going to do a little bit of a focus on a subset of the alternatives market called private credit. We're going to talk about two specific examples, and those are portfolios that have been yielding between 7.5% and 8.5% consistently for the last decade.
What's your big worry going forward? And don't let me put words in your mouth after my editorial.
Well, the funny thing is it's almost like I was feeding you talking points for your editorial today, because it's about government incompetence and overspending leading to a bond crisis. They do not control the bond market. Bond markets are controlled by investor confidence. And so even if governments are counting on being able to keep interest service costs low and thus making this overborrowing somehow affordable, it's just not going to happen, because they don't control the bond market.
Well, just a reminder, by the way, Andrew is president of Integrated Wealth Management in Calgary. You can go to www.integratedwealthmanagement.ca. But I think this is a huge subject that he's dealing with in this webinar. So take advantage of the expertise. Go to mikesmoneytalks.ca and just click on and join the webinar, which will start immediately after our show. Andrew, thanks very much. And I'm looking forward to the webinar myself.
All right. My pleasure. Have a great weekend, Mike.
Time now for the quote of the week. Jen Gearson is a well-known columnist. I've read her in the National Post, New York Times, Washington Post, and many others. Simply put, I think this is the best summation I've read of Canadian politics in a long, long time. In quotes, "Canadian politics is water polo. It's an elitist sport, the kind of thing that attracts debate club frenemies from Queens and McGill, because they thought they could use power to push a few pet policies forward and put a few more letters in front or behind their names. The result has been a political class that is intellectually weak and complacent and utterly unprepared for a real crisis. It draws from an echelon that is insulated from the economic and mortal threats that Canadians are now facing en masse. We've all made a good game of complaining about how awful 2020's been. Consider this possibility, and it's just a possibility. 2020 isn't going to be the year we all look back on with grim nostalgia as the worst year ever. This year might be the year when the really bad got started. When history reasserted itself. I'm not in a state of total despair about this possibility, but nor am I ruling it out. Politics, leadership matters again. And to meet this moment, we've allowed ourselves to be governed by sweet summer children, with a charmed prime minister who has decorated himself in rhetorical frivolities for the funeral of the beautiful old world." I invite you to consider what she's saying. I looked at that quote and I wonder, is that just because I agree with it? I guess the most part I'm saying is, my worry is also that this is not the end of the worst year ever. It's the beginning of a cycle. And in fact, I'm betting on it. And in fact, I'm betting I'll be right. Very pleased to, not better time than to get quality guests on with me, and I got one right now. I've got Mark Leavitt with me. He's the founder of Leavitt Newsletters. He's also been Timer's Digest. As you're a regular in the show, you know this. He's been Timer's Digest Timer of the Year. He's been Gold Market Timer of the Year, long-term stock market timer of the year. He's been a great friend of this show, and I'm pleased he's finding time for us this weekend. Mark, great to have you.
Great to be here, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, every time we talk, we have to start kind of the same way, and I want to get your, you know, we're coming into a, you know, an election, a U.S. election in the States, obviously. You know, there's a lot of signs that it's going to be chaotic. You know, I've been calling it going to be the nastiest in my lifetime for sure. Just tell me the impact on the stock market worries me. Tell me where we're at, do you think, in the broader market?
Well, we're still in a corrective phase. You know, our model said it worked out really well. We put out this annual forecast model every year, which is available on our website. But, you know, when it starts working so well, I start getting nervous. But it was put out in January, and it called for a low in March and a rally all the way to the end of August. And sure enough, market topped out September 1st, and now we're in a, you know, corrective phase. It looks choppy between now and year end, but there will be a big rally opportunity. But it, just as a hint, I mean, basically it's saying I would be careful until at least mid-October, and then we'll go from there. You know, maybe the polls or maybe sentiment will turn more positive for a Donald Trump victory, and the market will rally into or just after the election. But it still says we could be choppy even after that. So, you know, we put that together with our volume work and, you know, other indicators, sentiment and so forth. So we're short, you know, we're in the inverse indexes, we're trading them. Interesting, though, some individual stocks are still very tradable, a lot of individual opportunities in all kinds of sectors. So the market hasn't fallen apart. There's still, you know, tradable stuff out there. And but as a general market comment, you know, buyer beware here until the middle part of October.
Well, one of the things that's important, though, for people who don't do their own modeling and they don't understand the significance of having your model in tune with the market, like you follow your model. You don't make it up. You don't have opinions, if you know what I mean. It's the model gives you signals. You follow the signal. And my experience is when your model starts clicking over, and as you say, your model called for the correction into March, calls for a rally into the end of August, and all of that clicks on, and then that tells me the probability of accuracy going forward has been increased because it tells you your model is actually in tune with the markets.
Yeah, we're very lucky. We've been doing that darn thing since 1987, and we created it back then, Mike, and it actually projected a potential crash in October of 87, and when it actually occurred, I continued to do the model. It was sort of a lark that I even created the darn thing because everybody wants you to forecast into the future. As a technician, though, yes. Technical analysis tends to be more short-term than longer-term, so I was surprised that the cyclical model worked as well as it did.
Well, let me talk about one long-term thing, though. At the World Outlook Conference, you talked about this, that you were getting bullish on gold. And I want to get a quick comment again on you on, first of all, set up the where we're at, broadly speaking, in the gold market. Are we in a bull market that's longer term, or is it just a trader's opportunity?
Well, I'm taking it from a trader's opportunity. I don't like taking, you know, long-term positions. You know, we find that you get too stubborn into something, you get caught. But the model said positive, but now it turned a bit negative here in the last 2-3 weeks. So actually, as a trader, we're only holding, you know, very small positions. You know, it's actually bearish here short term, and we've been correct in calling that. A volume turned negative, and the key is the U.S. dollar, which is forming, you know, a bottoming formation here. And if that starts to accelerate, that could put even more pressure on gold here short term. But this is not unusual. Just like the stock market, we tend to see pullbacks in the September-October period. So I think that's really what's happening, and there will be another buy point, and then the cycles would say strength from there into the first quarter of 2021. So as a trader, I have my finger on the buy switch, you know, for trading longs. We still have some core small positions, but we're not heavy. And, you know, you might see gold possibly drop another $100 an ounce here in the next few weeks before it turns back up again. And if it does, as I anticipate, then we should take out the highs and move, you know, we'll just have to take it a day at a time, Mike, in terms of making projections. I'm not going to sit here and project 2,300 U.S., 2,500, you know, 3,000. I'm just going to see what the model says and what the individual stocks are saying at that time. And then maybe after that, it could be over, you know. There's some real long-term cycles that I played with that said, these were created 20 years ago, that said, watch out, 2021 area could be a top for gold, even though we had a correction here for many years. So we could blow off here between now and the first quarter of 2021, and that could be a big top for a long time. So we got to watch that possibility as well.
Oh, that's helpful. No, I'm laughing because, you know, you're saying that the point we want to bring to people's attention to, you're not surprised at the weakness. You're saying be aware you could get another $100 here on the downside.
Correct, correct. And I could, you know, I could be wrong on that. The U.S. dollar could suddenly, you know, collapse here next week. The technical indicators are saying it's creating a rounding bottom. It looks like it wants to go higher, and that would put pressure on gold. At least in recently, we're seeing that correlation. Although over time, we've learned that you can't really tie markets together. You know, if the charts, you always say gold works inverse to stocks or so forth. That's not always the case. We've learned even in March, gold came down with the stock market. So I don't always like to do that. But at the moment, there seems to be a correlation, strong dollar, weak gold, and that pattern may continue here. It looks like it could continue for the next few weeks.
I'm talking with Mark Leibovitt. He's the founder of Leibovitt Newsletters, and you can find them at Leibovitt is spelled, by the way, L-E-I-B-O-V-I-T.
It's best Leibovitt. Way to reach us is vrtrader.com, Mike. Save yourself the spelling.
Oh, well, no, I just want everyone to be able to send you a thank you note when you're right on this. vrtrader.com, vrtrader.com. Just to let you know, next week I'll be joined by Martin Armstrong live here on Money Talks. We get the best guests for you because these times demand it, including Mark Leibovitt, who's been Timers Digest long-term timer, short-term timer, gold market timer of the year, all of those things. Mark Leibovitt, you can find him at vrtrader.com. Mark, let's just jump in. There's never enough time here, so let me just jump in and say, what are you showing on silver right now?
Pretty much tracking gold. It's in a corrective wave. The support around that 22 level and $20 an ounce. And you know, I think it's going to track. I'd rather be in gold than silver. You know, silver tends to be a little crazy over the years. Seems to disappoint the bulls. It always has disappointed the bulls. But it should track with gold, and we should be looking for some type of bottom here the next few weeks, sometime here in October, and it should rally up with gold afterwards. I don't have a target for you, per se. Again, I don't like to sit here and say we're going to go back to $35, $40 or anything like that. We're just going to trade it, see how the volume comes in, see how gold is acting, see how some of the silver stocks are acting, and we'll measure it on the way up. But I think the overall strategy would be bullish sometime in the next few weeks on a buy point and then long into the first quarter of 2021.
And let's go back to what you know, as I say, at the World Outlook Conference, you'd already done, you know, your Timers Digest, or sorry, the timing of the year. And so you said the mid-October period would be the low. Are you seeing various markets line up with that, just to reiterate? So you're seeing gold sort of line up with that, a little, you know, a few more weeks of corrective phase, silver a few more weeks of corrective phase, but also with the overall market?
Correct. Everything seems to be in tandem here. You know, again, like we saw in March when stocks and gold dropped together, you know, they throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know what I mean? So everything seems to be tracking together here. There are some individual standouts, individual sectors that are acting interesting. You know, like the defense sector, a lot of people are worrying about riots after the election. Some of the gun stocks have been acting better, and we, you know, we're sort of positive on that. And some people are predicting some food shortages, and some of the commodities have been upticking. So some of the stocks related to food and growing seem to be doing better. So there's, you know, there's the different sectors, a little opportunity out there. Believe me, we're trading and following those, but as a general rule, they all seem to be tracking here. So, you know, I'm not saying you can't have a big buy in October, big rally into November, December, then come down again. We're just going to have to watch the trading volatility. So much depends on the election, and as you know, it may not be resolved right away. It could be really tumultuous for a while. We know that.
Let me come to a couple of other markets for you. And I'm asking this because I've always cited you and Jim Dines as the people who brought to my personal attention and our audience attention. I'm thinking February 2014, off the top of my head, at the World Outlook Conference. You were the one who said, Mike, have a look at the marijuana stocks, especially at that point. You know, you've been on them like crazy. But at that point, you said, especially the ones that are going to be suppliers for that industry. And of course, that advice was excellent. A lot of money was made in that sector. tell me what you, and you've got, of course, have got, you know, you look at the cannabis sector every week or every day, but fill me in on where you think that's at.
Well, I really like the U.S. Related plays. The Canadian stock seems to be still stumbling over themselves. At some point, they're going to come out of their doldrums. But there, you know, there are companies in the U.S. Like Curaleaf and Cresco Labs and Green Thumb, and these may not be household names to you, but these companies are making money hand over fist. They're expanding, unlike the Canadian companies, which ran into distribution and supply and sale problems. So we have a whole list of names in the U.S. that are doing great, and a lot. I guess a lot of may be doing well in anticipation of the U.S. election, thinking that suddenly it's going to get legalized. But it makes no difference. These stocks have been doing well. Some made all-time highs here in the last couple of weeks. So, you know, we're focusing on a handful of U.S.-based marijuana names. And then with the Canadians come back into gear, we'll certainly jump back on those.
And, you know, and as I say, you write, you know, specific newsletter for this, the Canna Sector Report. So I just want to make sure people are clear on that. And you can subscribe to that separately by going to vrtrader.com and click on it. So, I mean, as I say, no one I know followed it more closely from the outset as Mark Leibovit on that.
Mike, we also had a big call of the, I don't want to take any undue credit here, but, you know, the solar stocks have been still doing great. Well, last year at the conference and the year before, I highlighted those, and I don't think that's done either. So it's amazing. There's always opportunity. We try to find those sectors, you know.
Yeah, well, you just read my mind. That was my next question.
Yeah, okay.
So let's, no, and it's because, of course, as I say, you have been on the solar stocks. You've done very well for your subscribers. Tell me, just give me the lowdown on them or where they're at right now.
You know, they still seem to be attracting the interest. A couple of them posted new highs this past week. So, you know, we're still bullish on the sector. And if you look back over time, you know, where these stocks have been in the last 10 or 15 years, they're still relatively cheap. So a worldwide push toward solar energy and, you know, one of the safest ways to play it is the index. There's a ticker symbol TAN, Tom Apple Nancy, which is the ETF for the group. That would be a good long-term buy, in my opinion.
And sorry, you've just reminded me, come back to the marijuana stocks. Is there an ETF that you think is a proper reflection of what's going on in that sector?
Well, there's several. There's several. You know, unfortunately, most of them don't emphasize as many of the U.S. names. So we have three or four listed on the in the website on the newsletter. One that comes to mind would be ticker symbol MJ. But I'd rather hold back in terms of a, you know, formal one only recommendation. I want to check to see if they're holding enough of the U.S. names here, which is really where the strength is going to come from. So I'll have to get back to you on that one.
Well, and my point being, just because someone, they have a title that says they're following a sector, doesn't matter, we could be talking any other ETF too. You want to make sure it's tracking, as you've just said, the stocks you want or truly the sector you do want. As you said, you want the U.S. exposure, so you want to make sure it in fact does track the U.S. exposure. So,
right, the U.S. thing kind of surprised a lot of the analysts. They all jumped on the Canadian names. Of course, that's where a lot of money was flowing, but... I'll get back to you on that one. Which one, if any, really emphasize the U.S. names, which I think are going to continue to do the best.
Well, I also want to thank Mark, by the way, sit down for this one because we were talking to your back office because, you know, when I get people on, I want to get a good deal for our people. So don't go to my website. Everyone else, go to the website, mikesmoneytalks.ca, because this is an incredible deal. Because I'm very proud of the fact that at the World Outlook Conference, we started by featuring the commodity sector, by featuring, and we're talking for investors, as you say, Mark, you're always doing the timing of it, but for investors, you know, we talked about gold, silver, other commodities, and I'm very comfortable having done that. And, of course, you do a metals resource newsletter, and I just want to make sure people understand that you can get a one-month subscription for $17.50. That's a tenth of the usual price.
Wow.
But I want you to go to Mike's Money. Yeah, I know, Mark. Sorry. That's why I don't talk to you about those things.
Okay.
I talk to the office instead. And, you know, you can try it out for that, and then you still get a Money Talks discount half off. So that's a real good tester. And I want to make sure I had time to get that out there. It's the Metal Resource newsletter. So just go to mikesmoneytalks.ca because I think that's an area of the market I want to really bring to people's attention. And I'd love to see what Mark Leibovit is saying about it. But Mark, I know you're busy with all sorts of things, and there's a ton coming your way, of course, to do. But I want to just say I appreciate you finding time on the weekend for us.
Always fun, Mike, and look forward to the World Outlook Conference, the virtual World Outlook Conference this year, too. It'll be great.
It'll be different. It'll be great. You'll be able to watch it in your underwear. There you go. Mark Leibovitt, VRTrader.com. You're not allowed to present in your underwear, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, VRTrader.com. And go to MikesMoneyTalks.ca and take advantage of the Metal Resource newsletter. Let's get Ozzie Jurek in here right now. Ozzie, are you still glowing in the massive success you had doing your first phase, I call it, of your Land Rush conference?
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, we were scared to death. You know, you're going on Zoom for the first time, 10 speakers, several hundred people on Zoom. And on Friday, I was feeling really good in the morning. In the afternoon, our internet quit, and I was frantically running around the office, my hood screeching wildly. And then luckily, Western World Capital gave us their boardroom. But, I mean, these are problems you don't anticipate.
Oh, my God, that would scare the heck out of me. Don't put that in my mind, because we will have an Outlook conference this year, and part of it or all of it will be virtual. So don't put that in my mind that could go wrong. Yikes. Hey, let me just ask you about the conference.
Yeah, it's 5 times larger.
Yeah, well, let me ask you about what are the takeaways that you had last week? I mean, I've got a few questions around it, but if I just said, you know, close your eyes, what popped out at you?
What interesting was that pretty well everybody was surprised at the speed of the recovery, not the recovery, just how fast it was. And so clearly our Phoenix speaker, Todd Smith, he's been with us for 10 years. He's not one known to be wildly optimistic, but he predicts a 40% hike in prices. Personally, I think in September we're going to have a 50% increase in September. I think it's going to continue well into October. Our largest landowner, Woody Nielsen, shared a story in 1981 where he was down $2 million. From there, he resurrected himself into the biggest landowner at one time in B.C. And the story is very interesting because he saw comparisons because, you know, how we all felt. And right now there's real drive into the outer town. The people want a cottage. They want to have sort of a place to get away. So when you look at the different things people talk about overall, they're fairly upbeat, but somewhat surprised how upbeat they are.
It's interesting. Last week's shocking stat chronicled how if you're moving from Los Angeles to Phoenix, the demand is so high that you pay, off the top of my head, $1,978 for a 26-foot U-Haul. If you're going back, though, the other direction, it was $188 or something. You know, so the point being, the exodus out of California into Phoenix, because the same numbers came up for San Francisco, basically. That could be one of the real proponents or, would propel real estate activity in Phoenix. Because one of the big things is people are mobile when taxes change, behavior changes, or some other thing changes. So I can see...
No question.
I'm in no position to judge whether it could be 40%, but I can see real strength in the market because of the incredible in-migration into that area.
Yeah, and then it's relatively cheap. And then certainly people, we talked about it the other week. I mean, they're moving into Florida. And again, for taxes, for less crime, and for some idiotic mayors that are in some cities. But you know, I personally worry about the next 3 months ahead, primarily because, of course, the election. I mean, if Biden were to win outright, maybe bad for real estate and stocks. If Trump wins outright, good for stocks, good for real estate. But neither is likely going to happen, Mike. As you talk about many times, this is, you know, blood of the street times. You know, here we have 44% Democrats, 42% Republicans. So the election is really fought about sort of those 10% that are undecided. So likely it's going to be a hung election.
Well, especially, I mean, and they're going to face this out in British Columbia, which I call it the Dr. Bonnie Henry election, because the NDP government there is riding the coattails of the provincial health officer who would have been there. Doesn't matter who is in government. Everything would have been the same vis-a-vis rules and guidelines vis-a-vis the pandemic. It still would have been, you know, Liberal Green NDP. She's a civil servant. You know, she's acting independently. But the point being, is this the time where you want mail-in ballots because they're going to take longer to have a resolution? That's my point. And in the States, we've been chronicling very closely the rise in civil violence. I've been thinking about that this past week and thinking people have trouble seeing beyond Tuesday, if you know what I mean, you know, the short term. Where do you think this all ends? And I share the same concerns that we've said, you know, I see this now a broader narrative, but when we started to talk about it a year ago, we said this would be the ugliest, nastiest, possibly corrupt election in U.S. history. And that has huge implications. So we'll have to see, you know, but I'm with you. That worries me. But one of the other things, did you hear any, did anybody talk about, you know, this move I'm seeing, and I'm reading different result, different statistics about it, all supporting that there seems to be a move out to the country in some areas, not every area.
It's no question. I mean, for instance, in the Fraser Valley, north of the Fraser River, things are far more active. You know, the Surrey area, the idea that 1,000 people a month are moving there hasn't stopped. They're still doing it. And the other thing that is a big surprise was the strength of the pre-sale market, say, in Langley and Maple Ridge. And we had Pete Reisner, who was sort of a specialist marketer for pre-sales. He's even talking about in Vancouver we have pre-sale market buyers again. But clearly we are heading out of town. Victoria, I talked to Rick Hogendorn, our long-term member, and you know, he says every house in Victoria, the single-family house that's listed very quickly has an offer on it. Mm-hmm. There's a real drive into Victoria, Kelowna, and because people want to get away from the city, but they still want to be in a place where they can go have their sushi and their entertainment and so on.
Sure. Well, that's why I've been a big fan of Victoria for a number of years, because I think the quality of life there is very, very high with all the amenities. So I still have full confidence there. Ozzy, I'll let you take the weekend off now. You've done your job. You did a great job last weekend. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me, Mike. And if anybody wants to still have the full conference, come to our website at ozbuzz.ca and get the video, all 7 hours worth.
ozbuzz.ca, ozbuzz.ca. Victor Dare joins me live from the trading desk. Vic, I found myself this week thinking back to what you were telling us the first week of September, where you thought there was a key sort of turn in the market. You called it the key turn date, but, and I'm seeing a lot of support for that, you know, sort of a risk off more right now, you know, so reversing the US dollar. I just want to give you, let you give us a sort of an update on your thinking in that regard.
Sure, Mike. I mean, throughout the summer, if we go back to that, you know, particularly July and August, we had the stocks, it seemed to be having a relentless run to the upside, led in particular by the tech sector, and then even that tech sector led by just a handful of really big name stocks that were racing to the upside. Also during that period of time, the U.S. dollar was being shunned. You know, we had in the futures market the biggest short position built against the U.S. dollar in terms of the euro currency like we'd ever seen. So we had this trend continue right until the 1st, 2nd, 3rd of September, and then like on a pivot, the market went the other way. The stock market, and if I could just say this generally, down about 10% from the beginning of September until now, just over 3 weeks, and the U.S. dollar has had a very dramatic turn, rising against nearly all other currencies at the same time. I called that turn a key turn date because a number of markets, stocks, commodities, currencies, you know, all seem to change direction on that date. And when a number of markets make a change in turn at the same time, to me, that's extra significant. You really have to pay attention and say, okay, something big is happening here. And it doesn't need to be, you know, a news event. I was swapping emails with Martin Muirfield earlier this morning, saying, what the heck was it that happened there the first week of March 1985? And he comes back with the Plaza Accord and go, oh, yeah, right, of course, that's what it was. But this time around, it just seemed as though that really bullish psychology that we had blew off, you know, like we had a blow-off top in terms of the stock market, most particularly in things like Tesla and Apple, and it was over. It wasn't like there was some real big news event. You could say, well, that was the cause.
It's funny, you know, or it's interesting because, of course, as you know, Vic, I'm a longer term kind of approach to the markets. I think you get the big picture right and you align yourself with it. You know, I'm talking investors. And of course, you have to look at it, you know, much more on a short term. You're a trader. And it's so interesting to hear your views on that kind of thing. And so when I see the U.S. dollar have its weakness and then starting to recover, I go, well, of course. You know, I mean, it's a long-term bull market in the dollar, and that, to me, hasn't reversed. And it's just interesting to hear the different factors that you're observing are coming into play at this point. And I guess the thing that people always want to know, though, is where do we go from here? We heard Mark Leibovitz say he just expects, phenomenally choppy waters coming to us. And go ahead,
Mike. Certainly, with what you're saying, something I've said so many times on the show here, regardless of what time frame you're trading in, you know, if you're an in and out day trader guy or you're an investor who's going to hold a position for 10 years, whatever time frame it is that you want to be in, keep the analysis and the trading or the executing of your analysis, in the same time frame. I can anticipate some pretty choppy action. Clearly, I mean, starting as early as Tuesday, we've got the Trump-Biden debate. Mm-hmm. That could be huge in this market, On one respect, the bar is kind of set pretty low for Joe Biden. You know, a lot of people have been saying Sleepy Joe, all that sort of thing. All he needs to do, basically, is just kind of be steady, and he's already, when you look at the polls, leading substantially in terms of becoming the next president. So whatever, the lead up to the election, and then, honestly, you can see this in the forward pricing of options. The options market is currently pricing a lot of turmoil throughout the month of November, which might imply that we're not going to know who the president is. Then, we've got the virus. The virus seems to be coming back in different places, particularly in Europe. So there's a lot of things that could lead to or cause volatility in the market. Very short term here, I really like what Mark Leibovitz said, and I don't want to quote him out of context, but he was saying, the U.S. dollar here has been key. It may just be that the stock market turned the way it did because the U.S. dollar started to go higher, and in a way that's kind of counterintuitive for a lot of folks when they look at what's going on in the States, and they say, how could the U.S. dollar be rising when there's so much craziness going on down there? And I would reply that the currency markets are a beauty contest. The least ugly candidate yep. wins. If you think the States has problems, around the world, apparently, the way people are voting in the market, around the world, the traders think other currencies are even in the countries there are even in worse shape than the States.
Absolutely. Hey, Vic, just give me a minute on your take on gold, because I know you were playing gold to go down when I saw it break, the old high that held for whatever it is, 10, 11 years at $1,923 U.S. dollars. We went above it. We knew that would make the market run a bit, but now we've broken below it. To me, that just signals weakness coming.
Yeah, we made a new all-time nominal high in gold beginning of August. We've slipped off about 10%. There's that number again. I have traded gold from the long side, Mike, but, again, my time frame, if I can trade a $50 or $100 move in gold, that's really worthwhile for me. At the end of this week, I've taken some lightly long positions in gold. That's the first time I've been on the long side of gold. I anticipated we would break through the August lows. We did that. I'm not saying back up the truck here. And the way I trade, I'm really prepared to be wrong. So if the gold market doesn't start to go to the upside, I'll be out of the trade. But both the gold market and the stock market here seem to me they may have had a correction. And now, from my perspective, again, I'm willing to nibble on the long side of the major stock markets and the gold market.
Great stuff as always. Go to polarfuturesgroup.com, polarfuturesgroup.com. You can get Victor's full trading desk notes, complete with any chart he's got, calls on various markets. Victor, go out and have a terrific weekend.
Thank you, Mike, and you too.
So mark this on your calendar. Next Saturday, I've got Martin Armstrong with me, and I'll tell you right now, that guy is in incredible demand right now, consulting with sovereign wealth funds, some governments, because, of course, his model, the one I've had the privilege of using since 1983 that I rely on, called so many of these events, including, by the way, the beginning of the turn of the market at late January. Then it called for a panic sell-off starting in late February with a bottom on March 23rd. Then the model kept on waiting to see when that bottom, and then finally said September 3rd, that was a bottom. His model predicted the Trump election and so many other things. But at any rate, I'm thrilled. He's going to be my guest next Saturday. Mark it down. Time now for this week's Goofy. Well, I'm going to start. It's all about shattering the myth that the pandemic has been hard on our political leaders, when in fact, it has never been easier. They think they've died and gone to heaven. They've got unlimited spending, but just as importantly, virtually no opposition, whether it's from other political parties or the media. Very little critical evaluation of their policies, and no political fallout. Every single leader in this country has seen their popularity and approval ratings increase during the pandemic. And that's not been because it's been a difficult time for them. You know, they're not worried about missing a paycheck. They're not worried about their jobs or their pensions or their expense accounts. All of it is secure. But most of all, they've been able to bask in the glow and take advantage of the credibility of their provincial health officers. Nowhere more so with Dr. Bonnie Henry in British Columbia. And even if the public doesn't like a specific guideline or restriction, and there are certainly those people who don't, well, the politician just gets to stand aside and said, sorry, I'm following the instructions of our provincial health officers or federal health officer. The pandemic and resulting financial and economic crisis is supposed to be a time when partisan politics are set aside. But come on, that's been a little too tough. That may have been the case really for like a week after the lockdown, but after that, no. They've been taking advantage of their position, whether it's federally with the constant press conferences, and we had just witnessed that again last week with the Prime Minister requesting special time from the broadcasters for his declaration that he said was non-political. It's been so good for BC NDP Premier John Horgan. He said to heck with the health emergency. He has to heck with his signed agreement not to call an election. He still called an election a year before the date he agreed to. In fact, he supported and set with every member of his own legislature and said, yeah, so what? We're going to have an election. Why? Because he's riding high in the polls, and it's thanks largely to the popularity of the provincial health officer, Bonnie Henry. One of the things I've been dead wrong on, by the way, with regards to the pandemic, is that I thought the health, economic, and financial crisis and all the fallout, from bankruptcies to suicides, would be enough to make politicians set aside their partisan interests. I was wrong, big time. But you might want to ask whether politicizing the pandemic or any other major crisis has actually helped. Has it helped keep people safer or mitigated the fallout in so many other areas? Let me repeat. You might want to ask if partisan politics during a pandemic emergency has actually helped. That's all the time I have today. A reminder, go on to mikesmoneytalks.ca. Sign up for the webinar. It's about to start. The clock is ticking on that with Andrew Rulin. And I hope you go out and have a terrific weekend.
Subscribe to the Money Talks with Michael Campbell podcast for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or anywhere you get your on-demand audio. For the complete show, daily podcasts, and more.